Hi, everybody. Today is Tuesday, September 2nd, 2025, and our friend Colonel Wilkerson is back with us. Welcome back, Larry.
Good to be with you, Naaman.
Please subscribe and hit the like button before starting this, because we can reach more people. And Larry, let me start with the summit, the SCO summit, in which we saw India getting closer to Russia and China. And how did you find it, the atmosphere of the summit?
I think this is an indicator, probably one of the most powerful one we've seen in an instant, as it were, of what I've been talking about, where power is moving inexorably toward the East. I read an essay this morning that a gentleman had written, Russian, I believe, and he encapsulated almost everything I've been saying in a very short space, maybe two or three pages. And then Ray McGovern came back and said, but this is all pre-summit, not post-summit, meaning Alaska. And so I had to go back and say, sorry, gentlemen, I know the original author of the article understands this. This doesn't have anything to do with pre or post summit. This is reality. And of course, his major point is we're already engaged in World War III. We have several theaters of that war ongoing right now, the most prominent of which are Ukraine and the one that's going to open up very soon in Iran. And all of us who've been talking about Iran, who know Iran a little bit more, and a lot, realize that Netanyahu has no choice. He is going to war with Iran. And so that's going to open up again. And then you could consider what's happening in Gaza and elsewhere in the area as another theater of this war already ongoing, because Israel is not going to be content. This is an age-old Zionist wish that is now coming true. They realize Netanyahu, Smotrich, Ben-Gavir, and a host of others realize they will never have another opportunity like this. You know, Nima, they tried this in 1956. That's what Britain and France and Israel's invasion of the Suez Canal area was all about. Eisenhower smelled it out and put a stop to it. They haven't had a chance since to go whole hog. The 67 war was close. The 73 war was closer. But then Carter stepped in and Sadat stepped in. And that sort of put a break on it. And then you had a sort of peace party in Israel, Labor Party, a liberal party, if you will. But that was all a facade, really. The Likudniks, the supreme Zionists, were always lurking in the background. They've been there since 1948. God forbid, Ben-Gurion was one of them. And so now this is it. They've made more progress than they've ever made before. They kill more people than they've ever killed before. They've destroyed more of their, quote, enemies, unquote, than they've ever killed before. They are not going to stop. They're not going to stop until they have established what the Zionist plan is for a greater Israel. That's Lebanon. That's Syria. That's part of Iraq. That's Jordan. That's part of Egypt. It might even be part of East Africa. That's their ultimate plan. You can't stop. So it is very much a theater in this war too. So you've got that. You've got the potential theater with Iran, which I think will develop because that's part of the plan too. And then you've got Ukraine and north and all the way to the Arctic, because it's brewing there. This latest report that came out about the Arctic and about the continental shelf in particular, and who has the most accessible and readily available continental shelf? Russia. And how much methane and oil is there prospectively? It matches almost the Caspian Sea in the bottom of the sea, where there's 100 years, according to some oil experts, of oil that could fuel all of Central Asia, including China. So the war's already on. The war is on. The theaters are ongoing. They're open. They're hot. They're featuring people dying every day. And we're all sitting around wondering where this is all going to go. And this gentleman in this article says, and I think he's right, it's going to world war. It's going to world war because you are not going to be able, the empire, the American empire, let's be explicit. The American empire in its dying days is not going to be able to arrest this inexorable, inevitable shift of major economic, military, financial, cultural, informational, intelligence, you name it, power from the West to the East. And that SCO summit, as it were, was a perfect example of what I'm talking about. How many people did you have at that summit in just three leaders? Just think about it. How much power did you have at that summit? How much money did you have at that summit? Just in three leaders. In India and China alone, you have 2+ billion people. And now we know there are probably 65 to 66 countries that are all kind of looking around as to whether or not they shouldn't have something like the group that China and India and Russia, the BRICS, and other things like that.
Yeah, SCO summit, like SCO.
Yeah, this is the future. This is not the past. This is the future. The past is Washington, D.C., and increasingly because of their stupidity, Brussels, Paris, Berlin, and other European capitals, and certainly the EU, which is stuck in the mud so badly that I don't think even if they got rid of the leadership tomorrow morning, they'd be able to get out of that mud.
I don't know if you saw Donald Trump tweeting this, and he's saying that literally he's after saying that India is doing this and doing that. He said it's too late for India to come back. What does that mean, that it's too late for India? India is not coming back. India knows what I think. I really believe that they know what they're doing with Russia and China. They know what they want from Russia, from China. They're in the process of improving the relationship between the two nations. I don't know if you saw last week, we had an article on Politico. It says that in the next 5 years, one of the wars that they were somehow afraid of, or they were somehow mentioning in that article, says the escalation would come between China and India. I don't see that coming. I don't see that analysis based on any sort of reality.
That's not, it's not in either country's interest. Even the occasional flare-ups between China and India over the border or over who's closest or not close to Pakistan or whatever it might be were just that. They were brushfire conflicts. They were never the kind of conflict. And I had to monitor them both as a military professional and then as a State Department policy planner. They never were the kind of conflict that you would think, for example, between India and Pakistan, that might go to an actual nuclear conflict. So those were manageable, and they managed them fairly well. If you look at the border deals they made and such, now they've been compelled to do what they've done. And this is the greatest compellence in the world. When someone is threatening you in a near and certainly potentially existential way, and threatening with nuclear weapons, and that's ultimately what lies behind our biggest threat. And that's one reason the Europeans don't want to back away from us too rapidly. Their nuclear stockpiles are a pittance. When you get to that point and you force these people together in the way that they have been forced together, and the way that this SCO summit, if you will, was indicative of, you've lost. You've lost and they've won. Now, the contest could be bitter and long, and the casualties can be great, depending on whether or not Washington and to a lesser, much lesser extent, London, Berlin, and Paris recognize this defeat and deal with it in a way that is commensurate with their power and the growing power on the other side and make some kind of accommodation. But Nima, we in Washington, and I'm increasingly of a mind that Paris, Berlin, and London are this way too, and maybe even Norway and a couple of other countries that lately joined NATO, we don't do accommodation. We do not do accommodation. We do, you obey us or we will kill you. I mean, we've demonstrated that across the face of the globe in the last 20 years. We'll kill you with sanctions or bayonets and bombs or both. That doesn't work. It hasn't worked very well for some time now. We've lost every bayonet and bomb episode we've created in the last 20 years. And now we've got opposition. Now we've got significant opposition. Nima, we're working right now. A group of us, on a letter that we hope Mahmoud Abbas will sign as the head, recognized by the United Nations, head of the state of Palestine, to the UN Secretary General, requesting a United for Peace initiative out of the UN General Assembly. Now, that takes a two-thirds vote. We've already got the two-thirds vote. It is not subject to veto by the UN Security Council or any of its members. If the letter comes and the vote is positive, then the UNGA and the Secretary General, by extension, as the executive authority, if you will, with the UN, is obligated to try to create a force to go to Gaza and operate under more or less Chapter 7 type rules, which means the rules of engagement authorize the use of force to establish a peace. Not to keep a peace, that's Chapter 6, but to establish a peace. We tried to do this, you may recall, in the Balkans with UNPROFOR, UN Provisional Force for Yugoslavia. That was about 39,000 soldiers. We figure we need 40 to 50,000 for this, and we would ask China to be the dominant power and to lead with the major troop contribution. And other countries could contribute as necessary. For example, you could have Turkish troops, you could have Indian troops, you could have Pakistani troops. We had some good Indian and Turkish troops in Somalia in 1991 and 2. This would put a stop to Gaza on a dime. Deploy these troops with the rules of engagement that say you can tell the IDF to get out of your way, and if they don't get out of your way, you can shoot. You can use your weapons. But I think if you put that kind of a force on the ground, suddenly put it on the ground in Gaza, I think you would either have a conflagration that would come out very negatively for Israel, if not completely negatively, or you'd have a dropping of arms. You'd have a ceasefire immediately enforced, because I don't think Netanyahu is stupid enough to take on a force that might have 30 or 40,000 Chinese in it. I just don't think he's that stupid. I think it'd be the end of Netanyahu, actually. Now, is there any real chance that we'll achieve this? Probably not. I'd give it 1 in 50, because, first of all, Abbas is going to be very afraid to do it. And second, the UN Secretary General and the UN Security Council, at least the United States in it, are going to be very adamant about not doing it, as are the other members like France and Britain. But I think it would send a signal that would so shame the United Nations and so shame Washington and Brussels and Europe in general, that we would get something positive out of it, even if the force were not deployed. But I would like to see the force deployed, and I'd like to see China do it. And Nima, I'd like to see one other move too. I'd like to see a powerful suggestion at the next SCO conference, if you will, that the United Nations headquarters be moved to Shanghai from New York. It's time. It's time. These are the kinds of moves that probably need to be made to accommodate this power shift and this power change, because it's happening. But I come back to my original point. I don't expect anybody in the West to do this. I don't expect anybody to do it.
Colonel, I really feel that Netanyahu, before, if something in that direction happens, he's going to attack Iran to distract everybody from.
Absolutely. Absolutely. The moment the UN Security Council agreed to do something like this and China said, yes, we'll participate, he would attack Iran if he hadn't already done it. You're right. You're absolutely right, because that's his last avenue of survival. That's really what it's all about. The survival of not only him personally and politically, but survival of this greater dream of these ultra Zionists, which has been with us for over 100 years, maybe longer than that. It's just now found an opportunity to come to full fruition with lots of allies. I mean, look at the allies he's garnered to himself, not all his work, but nonetheless, he's taken advantage of it. The dispensationalists and fundamentalists in the United States who want the rapture in the end times, that's 50 million people, Nima, 50 million Americans. And many of them threw their lot in with Trump because they thought Trump was some aspect of the Antichrist and going to bring all this along. I mean, you can't make this stuff up, but it's true. And Netanyahu was smart enough to ally himself with them. That's what a lot of these trips to the West Bank and to Israel in general have been, that Netanyahu's government funds and finances. They bring these Christian Zionists over to Israel. They let them touch the wall. They let them pray. They let them go out and see Israel. And they talk to them about greater Israel. That's what the ambassador to Israel from the United States is all about himself, Huckabee. You know, it's Judea and Samaria. These are words he uses, and he's our freaking diplomat in Israel. They've got everything they want right now, Nima. Everything they want, and they want to push it to the maximum degree. And you're right, Iran is going to be the place where they get stopped short. And then the United States has got a decision to make, and we've got a president who, among other things, seems to be pretty bad physically right now.
Larry, do you feel the possibility of using nuclear bombs?
I think that's always there. I think it's in the background. When someone becomes as desperate as we're going to become, and Netanyahu might become very quickly, then the nuclear genie is out of the bottle very swiftly. And Netanyahu truly worries me in that regard. He really does, because I don't think he would hesitate if he thought his life was in peril, political and otherwise, and if he thought Israel's stature as the state that and his role in it that finally brings about the great Zionist dream of everything that the Bible says they should own. Think Ted Cruz. These are the people behind Netanyahu. They think the Old Testament is the guide to national security decision making. And I don't know if Netanyahu is stupid enough to think that. But even if he's not, he's using them to the maximum degree possible, just as he's using people like Smotrich and Ben-Gvir to the maximum degree possible. The unfortunate thing for all the rest of us is these people happen to coincide with one another. And they are aiding and abetting one another in one of the most evil things that's happening on the face of the earth today.
Larry, it's somehow amazing looking at the Trump administration starting with the teasing Greenland, Canada, Mexico, and coming right now to the southern part, to Brazil and Venezuela. Did you see that the United States offers a $15 million reward for information leading to the arrest of Venezuela's defense minister?
Yep. And his name is $50 million for Maduro.
What is that? This is the defense minister of a country. What kind of information are you seeking for?
Well, I hesitate to go this far, but I won't at all. I think when you go insane, then you can look for, and that's really an adjective that describes Washington today, domestically and foreign. When you do that, all bets are off for anything. And one of the things you do is you expand your stupidities. You expand your insanity. You don't curb it. You don't rein it in. You expand it. It excites you when you do that. And that in particular, look at Hegseth and what he's doing with women in the military and what he's doing with Christian nationalism. This is unparalleled. You know, I spent roughly maybe 10 years of my life of a 31-year military career and 40 years in government, I spent maybe 10 up close and personal with the Pentagon in one way or another. I've never seen anything like this. Prayer meetings in the Pentagon. Prayer meetings that if you do not come to, you get punished. You actually get punished. Prayer meetings all over the military. Military people talking about things like the end times and the rapture and other ecumenical and what do you call these things now? We call them fundamentalists, but they're dispensationalists, I guess. It's the Great Awakening, whatever. And we've got all these nuts running around, putting Robert E. Lee's statue back up, putting his painting or statue or whatever it is at West Point back in, putting the Isaiah painting back in the Merchant Marine Academy, doing all the things that they're doing and bringing, I don't know if you've been following this, but bringing this pastor who thinks that women are only good for having babies, that women should have never gotten the right to vote and certainly shouldn't be serving in uniform in the United States military. This is Pete Hegseth's pastor. And this is the kind of stuff that he's promulgating at these prayer meetings in the Pentagon. He's even introducing this pastor to these meetings. Did you ever think you'd hear anybody in the early part of the 21st century? Hell, we're a quarter of the way through it now, talking about taking the vote away from women. That's almost prehistoric. I mean, in the sense of all the effort and energy that went in to do that and the rectitude that went into doing that. How do you think the women in the military feel now in the U.S.? I give you three guesses and the first two don't count. We're making a mess, Nima. We're making a mess. Everywhere we can, domestically, internationally, we're making a mess. And people keep saying, oh, wait for Trump. Wait for Trump. He's the great peacemaker. You know, well, guilty. Guilty as charged. I kept desperately hoping, particularly with the Alaska summit, I kept desperately hoping that this man would find something somewhere and strike go. He's as bad as any of them himself. He propagates this nonsense, this stupidity, this insanity. And what a time to be doing that when we need a leader who is really, really mature, knows what he's doing or she's doing, is good at that, and understands this change of power structure in the world and moves to accommodate it and deal with it rather than to fight it and die. Because that's what fighting it means. It means dying. But horribly, it means lots of other people in the world who don't need to die, dying too because of your wrath. And that's what we're becoming. We're becoming the world's ogre.
I don't know if you saw this map, Larry. It shows the pipeline going from Russia to China, the power of Siberia, and the second line is coming, going to Mongolia and then to China. It's they look at Europe. Look at what Europe did to itself during the war in Ukraine. Look at what they're doing right now as we talk. What's happening in the SEO summit.
But it's revivable. The pipeline structure is revivable. Nima, several years ago, I guess probably 30 years ago now, 25, something like that, I went to New York with Powell when he was chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, and we went to what was billed as one of ExxonMobil's, or I suppose it was probably a consortium of oil companies, command center. And I remember one aspect of the briefing vividly. A gentleman who was a fairly competent briefer, but had the details at his beck and call about pipelines and such, he pointed at one particular map that was like the one you just showed, except it was a global map with four sections. And what it said, what he said in accordance with that map, he said, "What you're looking at, gentlemen, is pipelines pumping and their capacities, pipelines under construction and their cost, and of course you're looking at where they are, pipelines projected and their projected cost, and you're looking at the future of world warfare. He just ended it up that way. And, you know, I'm sitting there thinking, I just come from Pacific Command where I was basically a strategist. He's absolutely right. You're looking at all the energy sinews on the globe. You're looking at the veins and the arteries of the world's economies. And there they are. And there they're going to be. And that's their cost. And that's who's going to benefit. And that's who's not going to benefit. And a lot of this is, of course, the pipelines run across these lands that get transshipment fees. So it's a good deal for the countries that the pipelines traverse also. And that was up there in the data stream. All of that shifted a bit now, and it will shift again in the future and again as more finds are made and as we maybe go more and more to renewables. And that's a worrisome thing about this too, is that we're still doing this and we're still doing it just Katie bar the door, you know. We're still discovering, we're still pumping, and we're still building pipelines. But that's a picture of the future. And you know where most of those lines are now, Nima? They're over there in that place where all the power's going. Or they're coming out of there and going into us to give us our our lifeline, particularly Europe.
Larry, in your opinion, how does, if you were to assume the feeling of Donald Trump right now in the aftermath of the summit, do you think do they really care about what's going on?
Nima, I think you're giving him credit that I would not any longer give him. I don't think he has the capacity to grasp what's going on. Nor do I think there are any real talented cabinet officers around him or sub-cabinet officers. Sometimes they're smarter than the cabinet officers, deputy secretaries of state, for example, and such, to tell him. I just don't think he's assembled a great crew for this kind of moment in world history. And he's certainly not a great president for this moment in world history, unless, of course, divine providence is looking down on us and saying, I spite thee, America. You've been very, very bad, and I'm going to give you the worst possible leaders you could have and weather it because the storm is coming.
Here is what Poon and Modi told each other during the summit, Larry.
We have developed cooperation at various levels. Trade and economic cooperation overall shows positive momentum. Tourist exchanges are developing. We closely coordinate our efforts on the international stage.
Mr. President, this demonstrates just how profound and comprehensive our specially privileged strategic partnership truly is. Even under the most challenging circumstances, India and Russia have always moved forward shoulder to shoulder. Our close cooperation matters not only for the peoples of our two nations, but also for ensuring global peace, stability, and prosperity.
I've been a diplomat long enough, short enough, to understand that you don't want to read too much into that kind of language. But in the circumstances which I just inartfully and poorly described to you about this shift of power, I think the world needs to heed those words. Whether they are for propaganda purposes, and by that I simply mean they're trying to get back at us in order to maybe eliminate some of the tariffs or whatever, you know, immediate tactical reasons for doing this. And there's probably some of that to it. But I think what we're watching is a sea change in the world's way of doing business. We're watching the first waves lap ashore. We're watching the first recognition by some fairly talented leaders that they are inheriting the mantle of global leadership. And we're watching them talk about it.
What was so amazing, they didn't talk about Ukraine. We haven't heard anything about Ukraine. I think it was done intentionally. They deliberately decided not to talk about Ukraine. I don't know if Russia was asking for it or somehow China didn't like to be mentioned, Ukraine to be mentioned. What's your feeling on that?
No, if they could, and if Putin were amenable to doing it, I'm sure, and he had the money and the time, I'm sure he would build a wall 60 meters high and all across the front lines and say to the other side of the wall, Germany, Poland, France, England, all the NATO countries, go to hell and fester in your own poison. Me and my Indian and Russian friends on the other side, and my Indian and Chinese friends on the other side, if this were Putin speaking, we're gonna have a pretty good world, and we're gonna enjoy it. And by the way, we are four-fifths of the world. They can't do that. They can't do that, and they know that. So they've also got to be talking behind the scenes probably now about how they're gonna handle this mess that we've created and continue to create and will continue to create until the sudden body blow comes that hopefully convinces us that it's worthless to dispute this. It makes no sense. I'm not talking about surrendering. I'm not talking about chew-hoying, holding your hands up in the air and saying, I give up, run over me with a tank or whatever. What I'm talking about is dealing with the world as if it were human. And that all the people in the world, and especially those with the premier power, have a right to deal in the way that they wish to deal. And if you have some problem with that, you settle the problem by other than mechanically military means. You talk, you work, you use diplomacy, you solve problems together. I'm convinced. And I've had a lot of exposure to China, not so much exposure to Russia, but lots of exposure to China. And China is the number one power in the world, Nima. Today, China is the number one power in the world. They don't want this kind of conflict and this kind of friction. They understand they're human enough to know that there's some of that in the world. You got to deal with it, but you deal with it with diplomacy. You deal with it by talking, and you deal with it by talking in a way that supports your surplus of power as opposed to the deficit of power of the other side. But you recognize that deficit of power because you don't want to hamstring everything that you're talking about. And that's what we're doing all the time now. So it's a different kind of world. We haven't dealt in this. We were really good in the beginning in dealing with this kind of world because we were pipsqueaks. We were pipsqueaks. We had the French, we had the Spanish, we had the British of all people. We had the Russians. We had people surrounding us. They were on the Mississippi. They were in the Northwest. They were in Canada. They were in Mexico. They were everywhere. We had diplomats, and diplomats had to deal with real power surrounding them. Now we've become, or we became, the real power after World War II. And instead of developing the kind of tools that would be necessary to deal with the world when that power somewhat attenuated and others' power grew, which was inevitable, look at your history books, Donald Trump, Marco Rubio, Bibi Netanyahu. Bibi looks too much at his history book, but it's the Old Testament. The Old Testament, to hell with the Old Testament. It's not a guide for life. Sorry, Bibi, it isn't. You have to come into the world with an appreciation now, United States of America and Europe behind it. You have to come into the world with an appreciation of power is shifting, and you have to deal with it. And that doesn't mean that you go to the back of the line. It doesn't mean that you get second fiddle or third or fourth fiddle. It means that you have to use your brains and your talents at diplomacy to affect the kinds of relationships in the world that, interestingly enough, the other side wants. Russia, India, and China, yeah, they can be bastards. Everybody can be. But if you sit down and talk and you work things out, you're a lot better off, especially if you're going to hurl nuclear weapons at one another. You're a lot better off than if you build up the nuclear or the military problems that cause you to go nuclear. And that's what we can't seem to get through our heads. I shouldn't find it all that difficult to believe, because this is what history reads. You know, this is what Mearsheimer talks about all the time. And John is absolutely right. Whether you're talking about rising power, sinking power, and the inevitability of war between them or whatever, the power dynamics of the world, I don't buy all of John's realism theory, because sometimes it takes you straight to hell. But I do buy the fact that you have to deal with reality more or less 90% of the time, or you're going to wind up in a real pig in a poke. And that's what we're doing right now. We're being idiots. We're being insane. We're being stupid. And we're led by increasingly stupid people. In all three branches of government, we have stupid people.
Larry, two countries were at the summit, Armenia and Azerbaijan. They were invited. They were, I think there was some sort of talks between...
Purposefully invited.
Yeah, purposefully, exactly. Because it's not about just Russia and Iran. It's about China and the Belt and Road Initiative as well. Right. And Iran talk with, from what we've learned, from what we've seen in the summit, Iran talk with Turkey and warning them what's going on in Azerbaijan. And it seems the same goes to Armenia. I don't know what would be the China's policy when they see what's going on with these two countries.
Well, when you get this kind of pipsqueak country, and I use that term purposefully, trying to muck in big people's affairs, you have to teach them, you know, every now and then you have to smack them upside the head and teach them. I don't mean you have to go in and create a genocide or kill them or whatever, like the Israelis seem to think is the solution for everything. But you do have to, teach them in ways that they learn, and they learn quickly so as not to cause any real problems, that they have to adhere to a certain set of rules. And those rules are more or less going to be dictated by the supreme powers in the world. This is another realism tenet. You have to deal with power as power is. That doesn't mean you have to be the Melian dialogue power brokers. That is to say, I'm going to kill everybody on your island because you objected to my being here. And maybe after I kill everybody, including your women and children, you won't object anymore. You think that's one way of dealing with it. But that's not the way the world should be run into the future, primarily because we're all going to die from the climate crisis or nuclear weapons or both. And so that kind of old school way of doing business, particularly the Melian dialogue or Gaza today, has got to go. It's got to go. We have to cooperate. We have to collaborate. We have to live fundamentally in harmony and comity if that's possible. And when it's not, then the bigger powers amongst us must smack the little guys and keep them in line. I'm lecturing you on something that the world has done for 5,000 years very imperfectly. And now, because of the existential threats confronting us, needs to do it a little more perfectly. It will never do it perfectly, but it needs to do it with a real sense of the principles of the relations of nations and what those principles stand for. And the best things they stand for are collaboration, cooperation, and comity, harmony. You don't do that with vast militaries. That's one of the things we should do. All of us should do, Nima. We should all make significant reductions in this horrendous military apparatus that we've set up, which feeds such a complex of warmongers that it's hard for leaders to even deal with them in terms of not letting them start a new war, not letting them profit off existing wars and therefore extend them. That's a lot of what Ukraine is about, is profiteers, war profiteers making money. And who's the most in the world at that? All you have to do is look at the statistics. The American empire, the number one death merchant on the face of the earth. Donald Trump revels in it. He loves selling billions and billions of dollars of arms to other countries. This is nonsense. This is not the way we should be facing the rest of the 21st century if we want to make it into the 22nd century. It's just not the way we should be doing business. And the worst violator of the proper way to do business in the world today is the American empire. There is no longer any question about that. Gaza has put the seal of doom on that. It is absolutely the case. If we can support Gaza, if we can fund Gaza, if we can do what Israel is doing in Gaza as our wishes, because that's what I think we're doing. It's Israel's wishes too, of course, but we're having them do it for us. Otherwise, we wouldn't be backing them. We're guilty. We're guilty. And that's not the way the world should be run. That's the reason I think it would be just, it would be tremendously impactful if China were to suddenly stand up and say to the UN Secretary General, under that United for Peace initiative that Mahmoud Abbas just asked for, we'll throw in 60,000 troops and we'll pay for the operation. And we'll provide the logistics, the ships and other things, because they don't have the air bridge that we do, the ships and so forth necessary to get the other troops that are contributory to the place. And by the way, we can use the Suez Canal because the Houthis won't bother us. The Houthis would probably get on board the Chinese ships and come on with them and be troops in the peacekeeping force. Look at what they just did to Yemen. This is unconscionable. I mean, you didn't think it could go any further than what they're doing in Gaza, but it went further. They killed the civilian government in Yemen. Yeah. Murdered them. I think it was 11 ministers or something like that. Those people don't have anything to do with the Al-Ansar and the war effort in Yemen. I don't know how we can sink lower, Nima. I just don't know.
And nobody knows what else Israel needs to do to just to tell him stop. That's enough. You're doing a lot. What you're doing is not doing. It's not beneficial, Larry. Look at what they're doing. Look at what is the outcome of what they've done in Yemen. What is the outcome for Israel? I don't understand it.
Rage. It's all I can say is it's Zionist rage. It's the kind of rage that Ben-Gavir shows when he gets angry. And I've seen videos of him angry. I've never seen him personally, but about, for example, not being able to, when he advances his wish to build on top of the mount, and he gets told no. That's a step too far. Right now, that's a step too far. But you better believe that as soon as they have gotten rid of the Palestinians in mass, they will take over that, third or fourth holiest site in Islam and desecrate it in terms of the Muslims by building the temple there, rebuilding the temple there, or whatever it is they want to do. You cannot make this up. Hollywood could not make a movie about this and have anyone believe it that would be stranger than what is actually happening or more hideous than what is actually happening. We have unleashed the devil. We've unleashed the Antichrist, to put it in these Christians' terms, and we've unleashed him in the former Holy Land. And he is Bibi Netanyahu. Now, there are many people in this country, I'm told there are maybe 40 million of them, who would say, in response to what I just said, Nima, they would say, hooray, hooray, God bless, hallelujah, because that means Jesus is coming down. And that's why they support the Zionists in Israel. They have no real joy with them, other than the fact that they think they're preparing the ground for Jesus to descend to earth with a flaming sword, kill all the unbelievers, and establish his thousand-year kingdom, And in the process, some of them believe they will be raptured up to his side. You can't make this stuff up.
When I look, Larry, at India, China, and Russia, I see countries, even Iran, I see rational behavior. They know what they need. They know what's their weakness and how they can make themselves stronger than before. You know, India, is their economy is so important. It's their security, is the future for the country. That's why they're choosing to go to improve the relationship between itself and Russia. The same goes to China. Iran is doing the same, in my opinion. But the problem with the mindset in Washington that they don't see that they need other countries. Even with Europe, the way that they're behaving toward Europe, it's something like, oh, we don't need any more Europe. We don't need Russia. We don't need China. We can be. This is the problem. If you want to save dollar, if you want to save the economy of the United States, you have to communicate with other countries.
Exactly.
You cannot isolate yourself and say, I don't need anybody. Biden, if you remember Biden in the latest interviews he had, said, we are the United States of America. We are indispensable. We are exceptional. And I thought that Donald Trump would be somehow different because he was talking differently before coming, being elected. He said, why we do need Iran and Russia to be our enemies.
Yeah. It's a mystery to me. I don't know how to interpret the man. I've given up trying to interpret him. But, you know, one of the things you just said, when we were doing the simulations of climate change, one of the things we looked at really hard with NOAA and NASA computer models and such was what happens when you get this shift in temperate zones, essentially because, and this is an oversimplification, but the global south is heating up, drying up, and becoming unsustainable of human life. And the north is becoming somewhat affected, but the effects initially, while some of them are negative, like too much rain and too much flooding, basically what they're doing is creating a more hospitable region for food, for life and such for a short period of time, maybe a half a century. You're actually raising wheat and corn and pigs and chickens in Manitoba, for example, because the heat is moving up into the Canadian provinces. Now, this discounts other things that might be happening to the weather, like, for example, the current that flows up by the United Kingdom going down into the ocean again and coming back up and being hot again, and London turning into Moscow, looking more like Moscow than London. But basically what that did was it made the northern tier countries suddenly become very jealous of what they had. And so they began manning their borders with machine guns and troops. Where have we heard of that already? And they began shooting people because these people coming from the global south, who were coming from desertified and no food, no water. Well, one of the reasons that India has some empathy for this, and the reason China has some empathy for this, is because they have contact. They have a part of the global south, if you will, and they are going to get real impacts from things like the Himalayan glaciers running out of water, melting completely, and then there's no water for Pakistan and for eastern or western India. And there's going to be battles over that if we don't work something out. This is coming to bear much earlier, I think, than we predicted in terms of the way the North looks at the South and deals with the South, particularly in the Western Hemisphere. Europe's got this problem massively with immigration. Some of this immigration is not just war-produced immigration. It's global South climate change-produced immigration. No one wants to admit that. certainly not the CEOs of Total and Royal Dutch Shell and ExxonMobil who are responsible for all this and might be sued ultimately, just like the cigarette industry was. They don't want to admit that. We don't want to admit that. Our leaders don't want to admit that. That's why immigration is happening. And it isn't going to taper off. It's going to get worse and worse and worse. Well, China and Russia and India, I think, recognize that much better than we do for various reasons. But they're trying to create cross currents in that situation with the Base Road Initiative, central, northern, and southern. They're trying to create cross currents that not only handle the shift of power I've been talking about, but also handle the fact that we're going to have different places on the globe that we can't live. And we're going to have to adapt the globe to that situation because it's looking like we are not going to meet anywhere near our temperature goals. And so we're going to get to the point where we have to accommodate much more human life in that strata in the center that's still temperate, so to speak, still able to be farmed, still able to support enough water and so forth for people to live. That's going to happen if we don't make our goals, and it doesn't look anything like we're going to. So I take China and now India, and China can instruct India in a lot of this, Russia, I take them as being the three powers that recognize enough of this right now to where they're taking some precautions. They're doing some things that are going to enable more people to survive. And you can say, okay, China wants more people to sell its products to. China wants more people to be slaves. Okay, I don't buy that. The people who look like they want people to be slaves live in the Northern Hemisphere and live in the Western Hemisphere. Anyway, that's a long disquisition where I think they have a better understanding of the future. And I think they're accommodating that future through that understanding much better than we are. I think we have a very poor understanding of the future. Look at what Trump is doing to dismantle all the positive moves made in the last 20 years, some of which I like to think I had a little bit to do with even, with regard to the climate. He's dismantling almost all of that. And this is to our detriment. Is he suicidal? Is he nationally suicidal? Does he want to hasten the end of the Western Hemisphere, particularly its predominant power, the United States? Who knows? But I don't see that kind of attitude in Moscow, Beijing, or Delhi. And as a matter of fact, I don't see it in Kuala Lumpur, Jakarta, or any place else out there where the power is going.
Larry, here is in this photo, you can see the Russian Chief of General Staff, Valery Gerasimov. And the map behind him is the Novorossiya, as they call it. Novorossiya is the eastern part of Ukraine. And the map goes to Odessa, Nikolaev, goes up to Kharkiv. And how do you see the battlefield in Ukraine? How do you see the future of eastern part of Ukraine? Do you think Russia is considering, in this map, they're not considering any sort of buffer zone. The region is totally part of Russia. And the region includes Odessa, Nikolaev, going up to Kharkov. What's your take on this?
I see that as the result of our intransigence and our lackeys' intransigence, Volodymyr Zelensky, and our compatriots in Europe and in Brussels in particular. I see that as a result of that. This is not what was inked in Istanbul. When was it, February 22? This is not the agreement that was inked in Istanbul and almost became the end of the war, except for Boris Johnson acting on our advice, I'm sure, or on our direction, and London, Paris, and Berlin's direction. This is not it. Why is it different if we are to take that as what Russia's bottom line is? It's different because they have lost 300,000 to 400,000 people on a battlefield where they killed about 1.5 to 1.7 million Ukrainians and won the damn war. That's why it's different. You are very lucky, Keith. It doesn't include you.
I think, Larry, India, in the aftermath of this summit, would be, we can consider India much closer to China than before. Because they've made, because after several years, I think after 7 years, 8 years, Modi going to, the Prime Minister of India going to China for a summit. This is not something to be ignored.
But they didn't just do this, Nima. I mean, it seems like that maybe, but they've been working on this. They have. Moscow and Delhi have been working on this for some time. I think the precipitate way it happened ultimately in that summit was unexpected by everyone, including them. But it was time, they felt. And I'm sure they had many a phone call, and it was time that they sent a signal. And that signal had to be powerful and strong, resilient and meaningful. And it was. Now, will Donald Trump understand anything about that? No. Will Marco Rubio? No. Will Pete Hegseth? Absolutely no. Will Steve Witkoff? No. Will anyone in the American government? I like to think there might be two or three people down there in the trenches that will understand that. Will they be listened to? No.
Yeah. They thought that Russia and China would never be close as they are right now. It happened during the war in Ukraine.
I can remember some people saying the same thing about the United States and China, especially in the early 50s and mid 50s. You know, and then Nixon gets on his horse and Kissinger goes to Pakistan. Phew, bap, dude, all of a sudden, close his lips and teeth. The world changes, and the world changes on a dime sometimes when people are smart and understand that if they don't spend that dime, they're going to not get any change. They're going to die. And it happens, and it happens for the better sometimes. It happens for the worse other times. The Molotov-Ribbentrop compact, for example. Hitler turns around and invades the Soviet Union. Didn't see that one coming, said Joe. Yeah, I think Joe did see that coming. He just didn't see it coming so fast. Stalin, I mean.
Yeah.
But this summit should have been seen as coming. I mean, the SEO, you have no idea, Nima, how many times I would suggest, having just come back from China, I would suggest to the powers that be, and at that time, the powers that be were some half-decent people, Colin Powell being amongst them. And I would say the Shanghai Cooperation Organization is going to develop. It's just those Chinese doing it. I'm sorry. You're looking at the most, at that time, you're looking at the potentially most powerful country on the face of the earth coming back because it's been there before. We forget China has been there before. Persia has been there before. They're coming back. Not the same, of course, very different, modernized, whatever. But they're coming back. And just their populations alone tell you that when I said the SCO will be reckoned with someday was not a by chance calculation. All you had to do was look at the populations to understand that that's where, you know, 2 billion people live in two countries. You can't keep snubbing your nose at 2 billion people, especially not when person for person, they seem to be a hell of a lot smarter than you.
It's amazing to look at the two administration, the Biden administration, and right now the Trump administration, what the Biden administration couldn't achieve. I think what's going on between Russia and China is the achievement of the Biden administration. But what was left behind was the relationship between Iran and Russia, Iran and China, which is just changing drastically. Uh-huh. India and China is changing drastically. These are the achievements of the new administration in Washington. They're helping each other in making the East more powerful, more united than before.
That's usually what happens when empires take to the street, so to speak, to prevent their own collapse. They expedite it. They actually facilitate it.
Thank you so much, Larry, for being with us today. Great pleasure, as always.
My pleasure. Thanks for playing a little clip of Randy up there in the beginning. I hope he's out of jail.
Yeah, I hope that. But he was not arrested. He was arrested?
No, we were kind of struck by what they said about no children. So he went through the computer and took all the things that had children in them. As you can imagine, they were some of the most powerful photographs, most powerful videos too. So he went through, I think he had about 12 left or whatever. But you know what's happening in the district right now? I mean, you've got militia from three states, as I understand it, including the Guard, federalized by the president, which under the home rule, he can do. You got West Virginia. I know someone told me the other day they'd seen a West Virginia soldier down there. You got the FBI. They are routinely patrolling the streets now. And you've got ICE. You know what? My taxi driver this morning was an Afghan. And he was a little bit reluctant to go into D.C. And I noticed some reluctance when I call for the taxi company is run by the Pakistanis. There was reluctance for any of them. One of them turned around and went back. He wouldn't come. But this gentleman came. He's been here a long time. He was from, I forget where he told me he was from now. But he had trekked all across Afghanistan. He took his family into Pakistan as soon as we invaded. So he's a smart guy. Anyway, I found out he had all his paperwork and everything. But they were very antsy, some of them, about going into Washington because they're taking people. And, you know, even if your paperwork is squared away, that's tough. You get arrested and put away somewhere. This is happening on the Capitol streets. And you don't want to get disappeared, you know, Pinochet style. How do you say that in Brazil? Do you say Pinochet or Pinochet?
Pinochet.
Pinochet? Like an A? Yeah. I've had people tell me it's Pinochet.
No, it's Pinochet, not A. Pinochet. Yeah.
Pinochet.
Okay. Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
Either way you say it, he's a horrible person.
He's the same. Doesn't yeah, the same outcome.
Yeah. A Netanyahu in the making.
Yeah, exactly the same. Thank you, Larry. Great pleasure as always. Yeah. See you on Friday.
See you on Friday. I got to get me another shirt. I got to get one that's red and green and blue. And
waiting for that.
Take care.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.